happy. What'd you get into last weekend? Anything?
Yeah, I got to go to my first Beaujolais.
What's that?
Wine party. It's like this wine that only comes out like the third week of November. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely amazing. I got to actually meet people, collectors through in the city that are hosting artists at their home over the next couple of weeks to get the word out about them and to collect great art.
Amazing.
Yeah. How about yourself?
I did nothing. Let's talk about the news.
Love it.
PMA, Daniel H. Weiss, former president and CEO of New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art, has been appointed the new director and CEO of the PMA. He will start December 1st, and his contract will ride until 2028.
What a powerhouse to bring us into our 250th anniversary.
Let's go. We're going to go to the Gustav Klimt sale. Let's just acknowledge this, and then we got to get out of here, okay?
Yep.
$200 million for the Gustav Klimt.
Yeah.
Did you know that I did a major project on him in the Viennese Secession during grad school? A one-hour presentation on modern architecture of the Viennese Secession to a bunch of architecture students.
Ooh.
A class led by distinguished Dr. Richard Etlin. If you know, you know.
Can we also talk about how amazing Lauder's collection and breadth of collection had then brought in $500 million? The opportunity to collect art through your entire life and just love it so much to end up, you sell it for $500 million?
Eat the rich. All right, Robert, on to the conversation.
On to the convo. This is Robert Marsh, and you're listening to Philly Has Heart Podcast. In this podcast, we sit down with the artists, gallerists, educators, curators, and other creatives who comprise the Philadelphia art world to discuss upcoming performances, exhibits, and other events and initiatives that are not to be missed. The art scene in Philadelphia is so rich that it can seem daunting. Consider this your weekend cultural recommendation. With me always is my producer, Lucinda Dierland.
Hello, hello. Joining us today is Andrew Cole of Trotter Cole Advisory. Welcome.
Hello, everybody. Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Today, I get to introduce Andrew, we decided, because I initially met you back when you worked at Locke's Gallery, which wasn't all that far back, actually.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I was in, I think, on a Friday evening, looking at the Robert Wynn exhibition on the first floor. I was looking at all of these pieces of glass and mentally wondering, how do these get installed in a way where it honors the artist's spatial thought? And you explained mm-hmm. it to me. You said that there was a template.
Yes. So for those of you who are not familiar with Rob Wynn's practice, he is a multimedia artist, and he essentially is known for these beautiful, like, sprawling glass abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
So they are at most a quarter of an inch, half an inch, you know, thick, but they could range from one tiny little circle to what almost looks like a paisley feel.
Mm-hmm.
And they could be, imagine just a wave of cascading glass pieces kind of fit together. It's this amazing combination of material, but also with this abstract sense that I think a lot of people find a little more approachable. It reminds them of abstract painting, but it truly is through trial and error. He actually threw a piece of molten glass when he was practicing glass blowing
mm-hmm.
on the ground, and it created this just, not shatter, but again, this splash.
Yeah.
So imagine that falling, that color, all of those elements coming together, and he saw, oh, if I just put this on the wall, I create this whole new practice, and it is just absolutely phenomenal. I find them very meditative, very lustrous. And Rob is one of the sweetest, sweetest artists, people, humans out there.
Wow.
So I've always loved working with Rob.
But we're going to get back to you, Andrew.
Yes.
So the way Andrew and I connected beyond that day, which was, I think, serendipitous. After that Friday, our marketing consultant, Becca, actually went up to New York. And I had mentioned the podcast to you. She went up to New York for the weekend. I think it was a baby shower or a wedding shower or something to that effect. And she was talking to somebody who had a nephew in Philadelphia and who worked at an art gallery. And Becca said, my friends run an arts podcast in Philadelphia. Your aunt then texted you.
Yep.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if it was on the spot, but it felt like I had just met Lucinda.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm getting a text, but again, felt like less than 24 hours after saying, do you know Lucinda? She has this art podcast, and I'm trying to channel my amazing aunt who is generously hosting us for Thanksgiving this week.
So nice.
I will be seeing her
actually, in
a few days. But yeah, small world.
Make it smaller because I think the week later we ran into each other because we actually live in the same neighborhood.
Perfect.
All right, bring us to the Q&A, Robert.
All right. Andrew, as we do with all of our guests, we ask them to bring us back through your journey. And so what brought you to your role that you're in now, both big and small?
Sure. Let's see. I like to say that art is the only interest of mine that has really never waned. I've never practiced it necessarily. It's always sort of touched my life in one way or another, and I've been involved in it, mainly from a sort of inquisitive place. My grandfather, who was a cop by trade, was a very talented photographer, watercolorist, sculptor, so there was always art in the house. My father also was a great draftsman, and he could paint as well, so I read a lot of books, I learned a lot about it, and by the time it got to me to put, you know, pen or pencil to paper, it just was not... was not hitting.
Was
I couldn't, I couldn't draw a straight line with a ruler kind of thing. But I loved it. I love the different perspectives. I love seeing evolution and uses of color through art history. I just loved how people explored different media and created new movements and new ways to express things that were either very personal or very circumstantial, political. And I just thought, wow, this is such a... at once personal kind of interaction, but also personal expression. So it's so amazing how it could create kind of so many different things to so many different people besides just an artist's original intent. So I wanted to learn more and more and more. And when it came time to figure out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, which I guess I still kind of am.
Yes.
I wanted to at least be adjacent to this field that, again, I just keeps, you know, keeps me interested and passionate.
Yeah.
And again, because I never really, you know, had the discipline or the drive to go down the road as an artist, I found all these different ecosystems, be it the museum ecosystem, the gallery ecosystem, the auction house ecosystem, the foundation ecosystem, the philanthropic route, and how all of those kind of intertwined. And that was really instilled in me when I went back to grad school for a master's in arts management at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And that was a phenomenal, phenomenal art town.
Yeah.
I mean, you have Warhol. Carnegie, the Warhol, the Mattress Factory, which is my, I think, still... easily top five museums worldwide.
Wow.
It is all installation art. So it really is that, you know, kind of expression. And for those who maybe don't have those classic chops, you could see how you can, as an artist, really express yourself in ways that will just kind of change how someone will see the world. So I think the Mattress Factory is a phenomenal experiment.
Wow.
Noted.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to know.
Yeah, so if you're ever in Pittsburgh...
maybe we plan a trip to Pittsburgh.
I'd love to.
Philly Has Heart on the road.
Exactly.
Pittsburgh. Yes. I mean, I feel like, you know, I was there for only 2 years, but because I had friends there who stayed, you know, I would kind of go back and forth sometimes from New York. And truly, just like Philly, it has a small but very mighty art scene.
Wow.
And I feel just like Philly loves Philly, Pittsburgh loves Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's definitely a strong, you know, strong institutional representation. A little smaller on the commercial gallery, at least when I was there. Mm-hmm. But take it to the road and let me know.
I love that. I love that.
What was life post Carnegie Mellon?
So life post Carnegie Mellon was looking for a job, like any, mm-hmm. you know, like any student does. And I really didn't know exactly what I wanted to go into. As I knew I wanted to be in the sort of commercial side of the art world, because there was kind of a divide between mm-hmm. the nonprofit and the mm-hmm. for-profit, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
So galleries, auction houses, those were the things I was kind of focusing on. And I really wanted to do something that would get me as people-facing as possible.
Yeah.
I loved connecting with artists, connecting with collectors, connecting with people, like-minded people who love this stuff. And with that, I ended up in the gallery world. I was at a gallery in Chelsea. Mm. And I started as an intern because the bosses said, you know, well, we'll see what you can do.
Yep.
Was this after law required you be paid as an intern?
I believe this was
or
before.
Were you during,
this was 2014.
Was this the free intern phase?
I think it was still, yes. Oof. I think it was still the free intern phase, which, yes, for better or for worse, because a lot of people have cut their teeth and, you know.
Yep.
But just because the system is what it is doesn't mean it's right. And just because you survived it doesn't mean it's the thing that will benefit the thing that it's trying to serve.
Yes.
You know? So, yes. And now that I have a son over my dead bodies. But of course, I'm sure my parents did the same thing, but I said, oh, I could take it and make it work. And with the help of my parents, I did.
Yeah.
But still, you deserve to get paid for your efforts.
Yeah.
Of course.
I started out as an intern, and I just worked my way up. I had two people who were supposed to train me, and one left kind of in a blaze of glory, and another one ceremoniously exited. And I was like, oh, I'm the only person here, along with the ownership, of course.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, if you could open and close a door and you could talk to people, you can do this. So let's see what you could do.
Wow.
And it turns out within like a week or two of starting the internship, I sold my first painting.
What?
And that was very
incredible.
Yeah, that was very, very exciting. If I recall correctly, oh my gosh, it was a South African artist called Gavin Rain who did these like concentric circle pixelated portraits of celebrities and political figures. And when you hold your phone up to them, it just snaps into place.
Wow.
So, yeah. So that was Picasso or Keith, not necessarily,
right.
But it was, you know, it was a milestone, and there definitely was a great market for his work, and people loved it. They loved the interaction with it.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that it did maybe unintentionally kind of fuse art with technology,
mm-hmm.
because I feel like it's almost serendipitous, and that's how kind of things are going nowadays.
Totally.
You know, the way people are really taking in art on these kind of smaller tablets. So whether or not that was Gavin's intent, I think part of it was, but I don't know if anyone could have thought the, you know, extent at which we consume mm-hmm. art on our phone.
Right.
And I feel like that has kind of shifted our attention towards certain, I would say, figurative or more realistic art.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think sometimes you'll see something on the phone and it'll be, you know, so sharp and amazing, and then we see it in person, it kind of softens a little bit, mm-hmm. it loses a little bit of its edge potentially, but also on the flip side, you'll see something on a flyer or at a show or at the announcement of a show, and you'll say, like, oh, it's not really for me, but I'm a staunch believer in you have to check it out.
Yeah.
You have to experience it in person, no matter what.
I mean,
the business side of things, don't get me wrong, I love selling from a PDF, but people like that have developed an understanding and have not just necessarily, you know, on a whim point and say, yes, I'll take it.
Right.
They have to know the artist, the art, their aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get back to kind of that. And that's part of why I like going this advisory road.
Yeah.
But
so we left off where you were an intern.
Yes.
Where did you go from there?
Actually, I stayed at this place, Unix Gallery, for mm-hmm. about 5 years. And then the pandemic happened, and no one knew what the fuck was going on.
Right, right. Yes.
So, you know, while I was At Unix, I also did some curatorial work on the side, so I had a little... By no means is it a fallout plan. I would not recommend anyone having a side curatorial hustle as their backup plan. But with the gallery closing for the pandemic, and let's see, and my wife, she was my girlfriend at the time, she was furloughed. She was working for the Armory Show, an amazing fair up in New York. And we were like, we don't know what's happening. Right. So we thankfully took a little bit of time. I did some advising, some curating, as a lot of, I recall, friends doing. Like, big institutions were closing. Galleries didn't really know what was happening. So a lot of people were either doing DIY or they were selling through PDFs. Which, which, honestly, some galleries, I think it was like, let's see, 56 Henry down the Lower East Side had a, my understanding was like a banner year from it because people really rallied behind some of those smaller galleries that they, you know, not small, not insignificant, just small, like footprint wise.
Right.
Because 56 Henry's program is one of my absolute, absolute favorites. We were a little transient at the time, and this opportunity, I was, while I was kind of curating and reconnecting with collectors who I had met, this opportunity at Locke's Gallery opened up in Philadelphia. Ellie and I were in, we were living in Brooklyn, and I said, what do you think? She is a native, I say native Philadelphia person, but she did grow up on the Main Line.
Okay.
So, but she went to Friends Select. So she grew up in the Main Line and knew the Philadelphia art scene a little bit better. And I said, what do you think about me applying here? And I knew of Locke's because of the Armory Show.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have built such an amazing program. And she said, it's the best gallery in Philadelphia.
Wow.
Let's give it a shot. I applied and I got to meet Suyun Locke's, who is the ownership of the gallery. And we started working together. And this was 2021. So I moved down from New York to Philadelphia. A little unsure about going from an art scene like New York's to, I guess, what some people call a more regional scene. But as Suyun has built up this amazing program, when your regional scene is, because of this gallery, Linda Bengalis and Pat Steer and Louise Fishman and Louise Nevelson and, my gosh, who else? Edna Andrade, Jennifer Bartlett, blockbuster artists.
Yes.
So it was wonderful to work with that caliber of artist, with an operator like Suyun, who, you know, has built up the program from where Marion Locke started it in the 60s, and it was very female-focused. And actually, that is something that I really, really appreciated about both Marion's initiative and also Suyun's taking that initiative and really just ramping it up the... you know, the female focus and the sort of, in certain circles, less or underrepresented artists, that when I kind of took stock, I was like, no, these are some of my absolute favorite artists.
Right, yeah.
You know, I definitely kind of had a little pinch me moment when Linda Bengalis called the gallery and I got to speak with her. It was, it was absolutely wild. So it was a wonderful, wonderful place to work, a wonderful place to learn. I credit Suyun for teaching me so much.
Yeah. Oh, that's an incredible journey.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
amazing. And that was, 2021. So it's been like four and a half, nearly, it's going to like be 5 years, would have been 5 years pretty soon.
So tell us about that pivot to what you do now in art advisor. Like, what was your inspiration? How did you have the balls to go off and do something on your own?
Yeah.
Well, the name of the advisory that I am launching, Trotter Cole, I credit the change, the big important change in my life when my son came into the picture. His middle name is Trotter, and that's actually named after Trotter Alley here in Philly, in Old City, and that's where my wife's family was from.
Wow.
So we used a name that was, you know, important to her family, important to us, and important to Philly.
Yeah.
So that definitely got me thinking about starting something new, and as I say, when people ask how's it going with my son, I say it is equal parts exciting and exhausting.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But that excitement and that, for lack of a better word, that fear of the unknown shouldn't be something that stops you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to stop me from, you know, doing everything I can with this kid, for this kid. And so I thought this was kind of a serendipitous time to start to build something on my own.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So what does your role look like as an art advisor?
It's a few different things. And that's also one of the aspects that I do like. Working in galleries, you know, it is tremendous. And I feel like it carries a certain cachet, which is fantastic. And that's why you have these galleries, you know, like Lox, like David Zwirner, like Pace, that are just like household names.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of cool that they, you know, people have that in mind, and it builds trust for collectors and artists. And so the more you build on that, the sort of more you attract. But some people could see it in a very almost one lane way. As we talk, I may find another word to describe it, because I by no means I want to make it seem like it's anything of a detriment. But you focus on, you know, your roster, and rosters change, but it just, it's sort of one component of the artwork. And I feel like as an advisor, you get to establish relationships and champion certain galleries that you love, and also get to know certain artists that, you know, collectors that you work with would love, that may not necessarily be in your roster as a gallerist.
Right.
And so there is that, you know, if someone is saying, well, thank you very much for, let's say, for example, this Rob Wynn, but I'm also looking to take my collection this way, your focus can't go as deep as, say, maybe they would want to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, so I feel like it's a way to sort of give your energy and work to rise all of these parties, as opposed to, you know, you have to keep the gallery as the premium, or you have to keep the artist, say that you're a studio manager, as the premium,
right.
Or if you're only, you know, working with one specific client or foundation, like their mission is the premium. So this allows me to sort of touch each of those sectors in equal measure, and I think get me to just learn a little bit more and kind of see through conversations of where artists are going, what other galleries are doing, where collectors' moods are changing, where trends are going in the overall, you know, art market, and how it all kind of weaves into itself. It's always been more of a winding, you know, intermeshed road for me than of like straight ahead. This is the thing.
Do you find that you you're balancing more collectors than artists themselves, or do you believe that you have a great cohort of artists that you are pushing towards collectors?
It depends. I would say, if I'm understanding the question correctly, it's less the cohort of artists, because it really is, if I'm working with a collector, it's base. You know, it's really their focus.
They're driving first.
Right. And so, for example, I'm working with a couple that a big focus for them is contemporary, but also Jewish themes, the Jewish diaspora, Jewish artists. You know, with this Klimt that went for millions of dollars.
Are you behind the 200, wait, it's 247 million Gustav Klimt sale, because that
were you the bidder on the phone?
Hardly. No, no, sorry. I put my ceiling at 213 million. It's an easy number.
Yes.
No, that was wild. Absolutely wild. But I mean, it's the Lauders collection.
I mean,
it's
just the Lauders.
Yeah, they are, and that is a powerhouse. And I had the chance to meet Elizabeth Sanser, who is, I think, still running their collection, and they have built something that rivals most museums.
Correct.
Most, I mean, like,
Half a billion
countries. Yeah. It's wild. Like,
okay, I'm sorry. We have to get back to it. This is my fault.
But
did they have an advisor that helped them build this over time?
To my knowledge, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it'd be really cool to, I mean, that's, you need a lot of capital.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To do something like that. It helps for sure. But you could also build something that is just as meaningful.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so again, these particular collectors, Jewish, kind of contemporary. And so you want to introduce them to things like, kind of younger contemporary artists, obviously someone like Louise Nevelson, you would know, and Mark Chagall, you would know. Mm-hmm. But artists like Austin Wiener, who's an LA-based artist, she's mainly abstract. And while there isn't, that kind of distinct symbology, I feel like from the research I've done on her and seeing her practice grow, it would fit the collection. Who else? Someone like Paige Bieber, also another abstract artist, mm-hmm. who, big, big fan of, but... again, this is also thanks to Instagram, where you do a lot of your research.
Right.
But so you get to learn a little bit more about the artist, and you can kind of show a collector that, hey, just because this doesn't have the same iconography as, say, Chagall, mm-hmm. doesn't mean it won't fit in your collection or accomplish the goal that you're doing. And when you can do it for someone who's more of an emerging to mid-career artist,
yeah.
mm-hmm. I feel like that's really wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you do your research, right? Because you can go from such a wide breadth of artists and gallerists mm-hmm. to then stay on top of the changes or the trends or find that emerging person these days.
Well, I would say going to different galleries, going mm-hmm. to different museums. But as I said, Instagram, social media,
yeah,
for sure.
It's huge and now.
Changed the game.
It completely changed the game. I mean, more and more, it's funny, there was this is maybe 3-4 years ago, there was an article that was, I think the kind of hero image of it was just an iPhone, and it's like, Instagram is, this is your new gallerist, dealer, what have you.
Right.
And it definitely, technology by no means is going away. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And art and tech are very much finding, I think, are continually finding happy places mm-hmm. to settle and then feel disrupted and clash. But I know certain artists who have said they've sold, not necessarily having gallery representation, but they've just sold 30, dozens of works.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Through people who say, oh, I like this. How much is it?
Right.
For certain collectors, if it hits for the eye and the heart and then the budget works,
yeah.
then you kind of ticked everything. And
right.
it's a no-brainer. And again, it's great. You could go from seeing an artist directly on Instagram to then paying them directly on Venmo.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's all going to the artist. And
yeah.
That's fantastic. Also, word of mouth. And that's another thing that I'm kind of enjoying about this new kind of route that I'm going down is just the reconnecting with certain artists or gallerist friends, just kind of keeping that network going.
Yeah.
It sounds hokey, but
nope.
Community
it's all relationship based.
It's your aunt in New York.
Yeah.
Correct.
It's absolutely crazy.
Yes.
Absolutely crazy how that happened.
Yeah. What do you look for in artists?
Ooh.
Or should the question be, what do you look for in collectors to work with?
Mm.
You can answer either.
I mean, the cynical answer, because, this is, we are all trying to make our way in the world. The bigger the budget,
yeah.
Or should I say, you have to understand your budget. That's a big thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of when you have someone who says, oh, well, I have a 20-foot-high ceilings, and I want to fill it with this humongous thing. And you're like, okay, that's based on the size, the artist that you say you like, you're going to be at least upwards of $100,000.
Right.
Like, oh, no. Yeah. And it's like, well, that's why we have these conversations.
Right.
And that's mm-hmm. why when, right. as a gallerist, it's more like, well, then if this is a thing we're showing, and obviously, you try to show them whatever you can, but mm-hmm. it's more as an advisor, you could kind of manage those expectations, mm-hmm. walk them through, find what the right thing would be.
Yeah.
And do you ever walk into a space and maybe your collector says, I want something to fill up this wall, do you ever walk into the space and say, actually, maybe you take this approach and you do a, I don't know, a triptych or
Look
at me with my words.
I like it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I feel like there's no wrong approach to it, mm-hmm. in my opinion. Robert, to answer your question, what I look for in artists, and I'm going to try to dovetail mm-hmm. kind of back to this, something that, for me personally, I love material. I love something that is kind of tactile. You know, that's part of why I love Rob's practice, yeah. Rob Wynn. There's an artist that I fell in love with when I was first starting out at this gallery named Tom McFarland.
Heard of him.
He was doing these amazing rope deconstructed canvas paintings where he would add paint and joint compound dripping down these little twines within the canvas. So it was all the elements of a painting, but it was like deconstructed, almost looked like a Ava Hess element.
Wow.
Which I was like, I love this.
Yes.
I love that tactility, that materiality that you could like kind of go into it. But I also love something that makes a statement. I love something that's uncomfortable. I love something that's a little weird because, again, learning about art the way I did, my approach to it wasn't as formal, I don't think. So it was like, show me something that grabs my attention.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's John Deitiger. Might be wrong. German artist. I worked with him for one show, but he made these. It was a sculpture of birds.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
That had a sound component.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
And the collector just had this one space that was a perfect, it was a little strip of wall kind of going up a staircase, or it was as you turn a corner mm-hmm. to go up a staircase, and it just kind of fit perfectly. And I think a lot of people think, you know, oh, I have this space, what painting is going to go there? What photograph is going to
right.
go there? And who makes, you know, 10 foot by 18 inch canvases? Not a lot of people.
Yeah.
Right.
But you have sculpture that you could put. You could put a pedestal there. You could you could put birds that are attached to a timed loop of bird noises. And that's
wild.
What I,
yeah.
So you have to find that opportunity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And are you advising on more of a project base, or are you sticking with a client for a longer term to maybe not fill a blank canvas, but to help them curate their art collection over time?
It's both.
Okay.
You know, you ideally do want to grow with kind of one collector at a time to kind of really get their vision, because mm-hmm. then you could find something and you see these opportunities that you don't want
right.
to necessarily pass them by. But also, if someone has a really fun project that's, you know, is going to be a one-off,
yeah,
why not?
Oh,
I mean, that's
great.
The fun of it.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, Andrew, this was absolutely amazing. Where can our audience find you online?
You could find me on Instagram. I am
we'll link you in the show notes.
Excellent, excellent. For as much time as I spend on there, I should know that instantaneously. But yes, that's the best way to find me. And if it's about art, please find me.
We'll move into our rapid-fire questions. Could you describe the Philly art scene in one word?
Eclectic.
A slip-on Philadelphia artist that people need to know about now.
I would say emerging Tessway. I also locally love Quilisha Wood.
Okay.
I love Quilisha Wood.
Nice.
She's represented by Pippi Hallsworth over in London, so I wouldn't say that she is slept on, but
Philly sleeping on her.
not all Philly, because
yes.
there are some major collectors here in Philly, and that was also a very fun, interesting introduction to this city. Was
wow.
the amount of top 200 collectors that
yeah.
call Philly home, which
oh,
is
that's
very
awesome.
Very cool.
Set the scene. We are heisting a piece of art of your choosing.
Cole's three.
What are we going after?
We're heisting one and one only.
One and one only.
Oh my gosh! From anywhere in the world?
Mm-hmm. No limits.
No limits. Okay. Well, bring a forklift because we are stealing a... Oh, my gosh. We're stealing a Richard Serra. We are stealing, I think it's called 3 sheets by Richard Serra from the Nassau County Art Museum, which is my local art museum growing up.
Love it.
Love it.
I believe that's the tale of it, but it's these 3 amazing metal sheets by Richard Serra in this bowling kind of hill. And when you come upon it, like on the grounds, you see one and then you take a little walk and you see the other 3 emerge. And it truly changed what it was besides Jan Miro. It was the next touch point of art can do this.
Yeah. Cheesesteaks with whiz or without?
Without answering outside the question, without.
Okay.
I like provolone.
Yeah, that's right.
I like long hots.
Oh, nice.
But I also want to honorable mention pastrami on rye from Famous 4th Street.
Ooh,
oh, okay.
A delicious, delicious sandwich. Favorite art museum outside of Philadelphia and New York?
And Pittsburgh.
The Rodin Museum in Paris.
Favorite Philadelphia neighborhood?
Shadow Queens Village.
Nice. If you could have any artist in history produce a portrait of you, who would it be?
Alice Neal.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for your time today. The conversation was amazing.
Come back and meet with us soon, yeah?
Yes.
It would be an honor again. Robert Lucinda, thank you so much for having me. This is incredible.
Up. And if you are in town for the holidays, oh boy, do I have plenty of thoughts of how you can fill this weekend free of Black Friday shopping. But first, do you want to tell our listeners about our event on December 2nd?
Everyone, check out the Emerging Collectors Preview at the Prudence Center. It's going to be an amazing event starting at 5 p.m. There will be drinks. And there's going to be great opportunities to speak to the artists about their pieces and be able to purchase those for the benefit of the Print Center as they celebrate their 110th anniversary.
But also, no pressure, guys. This is mostly an educational opportunity to learn about caring for art and how to form a collection. Let's kick it off. For this weekend, Yannick Leeds Sibelius runs from November 29th through the 30th at the Kimmel Center.
Speaking of orchestras, tickets to Philadelphia Young Artists Orchestra on November 30th, also at the Kimmel Center, are available.
Drew Leshko's Amor Fati wraps up at Paradigm Gallery on November 30th.
Pi Gallery presents Tapestries by Nina Hans for the month of November.
A Usable Past, Reflections on a Nation and Its Inheritance, opened on November 7th at the Museum for Art and Wood and is ongoing throughout February.
An exhibition by Jake Weinstein, Clanker, is ongoing at Works on Paper Gallery and is nearly sold out.
Under 100, Under 1,000, Philadelphia's Magic Gardens-inspired works by Philly artists is ongoing at Magic Gardens.
Group show titled Materiality is ongoing at Bridget Meyer Gallery.
And with that, Philly has heart.
And art.
And no more studio time today.